Okay, we'll just do a quick sound check. So just say something for me.
Peace.
Nice.
Why don't we start? Go big, right? Go big. Go big.
That's what we'll put out there. I love that.
Hi, I'm Christiana, and I'm a nurse at the bedside. I know that it's unusual to include the sound check in an episode, but I think it really sets the tone for speaking with Leanne Jeffs, who is our guest today. She does, in fact, go big. But in going big, she maintains her focus on her sense of why, the reason for the work she does. Leanne is a nurse, a health system leader, and a researcher with a background in qualitative research. I've heard her refer numerous times to the way that narrative and storytelling can inspire meaning. And throughout her narrative, while she's discussing science and scientific ways of understanding and generating knowledge, she consistently returns to the central importance of compassionate human connection. Healthcare is a job. It is not a calling. We work to earn a livelihood, but we choose to work in healthcare knowing that it is a values-driven, moral endeavor. People trust us in times of vulnerability. And Leanne references mission, vision, and value statements frequently. Sometimes we get lost in the what and the how of what we're doing and all the busyness, but staying anchored to the why can help us navigate by staying grounded with the core vision of service when things get difficult, which they do. The belief in the inherent value of every human life is at the heart of healthcare, especially universal healthcare. That all people wish to be happy, to be healthy, to be loved, to give love, even when it may not appear immediately that way from the outside. And all people suffer. That one you cannot miss in this job. And when they seek health care, they are deserving of care and compassion, not just those for whom it is easy to muster, but all people, including those who are living at the intersection of all kinds of structural vulnerabilities and disadvantage that can contribute to making their interactions with healthcare difficult. And we encounter these folks a lot. These are the social determinants of health. And they do not always receive care and compassion. They do not always feel heard, respected, valued, safe, but they should. And that can be difficult. I also exist in this real world. I know this deeply and personally. I mean, there have been plenty of times when I, or those around me, have not been able to live up to my own ideals, our ideals. Or when interactions just, you know, go completely off the rails, or times when I've been on the receiving end of healthcare that falls short. It can be super hard to acknowledge and honestly assess our own role in it. But that's what's required to enable growth and learning so that we move towards our vision. It goes way beyond putting on a smile and being nice. That's important, but it's not enough. We also need to take into account the challenges that exist around us in our environments. Embodying care and compassion is extremely difficult when you are the victim of violence or racism in the workplace, or you feel like you're drowning in suffering, overwhelmed by secondary trauma, lacking the space or tools to move through it, as many of us are, or you're simply overwhelmed by the burden of time-intensive, low-reward tasks. When you are sleep-deprived, hungry, frightened, or if you find yourself in an environment where casual cruelty is normalized and human needs are ignored, these are all elements of the reality on the ground, and they need to be honestly addressed in order for compassion to exist or flourish. I think that you will see through listening that Leanne envisions a more just and compassionate world, and she doesn't ignore these challenges. She outlines a vision of how to move toward or co-create that vision, as she would likely say. You'll hear her say that complexity is great. Her vision of care extends to patients and to those engaged in its provision, and acknowledges the realities of the context, which is a compassionate approach. We've been talking a lot about compassion in healthcare these days, and I think it might be helpful to offer some kind of a definition. I'm going to take some words from a book by Sharon Salzberg. She's one of the founders of the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts, and her training and experience teaching is in the Buddhist tradition. In the book Loving Kindness, she writes, "To view life compassionately, you have to look at what is happening and at the conditions that gave rise to it. We must have the openness and the spaciousness to see both the conditions and the context. She goes on to say, a compassionate act does not have to be grandiose. It can be very simple action. Compassion enjoins us to respond to pain, and wisdom guides the skillfulness of the response, telling us when and how to respond. Through compassion, our lives become an expression of all that we understand and care about and value. To develop a compassionate heart is not just an idealistic overlay. It arises from seeing the truth of suffering and opening to it. And that's the end of that quote. And when I think of those in healthcare that I admire, who I look up to, in all different roles, they express care in that way. They are open. They have the spaciousness to maintain their own sense of self and boundaries while remaining present with suffering. They stay in the moment and see the context and the wisdom of how and when to respond to pain, drawing upon skills and training and shared humanity. That's the professional role. And they're certainly not perfect, but they're human in so doing. I think that compassion is the foundation of healthcare and that it can be fostered individually and collectively, which is very important for healthcare, with healthcare delivery being very much a collective act. And here's Sharon Salzberg again. Our commitment to compassion should be to create conditions so that people can more easily be moral. End quote. And as a leader, I think this is where Leanne is trying to work, you know, on creating those conditions. So thank you for listening.
Okay, Leanne, thank you so much for joining me at the bedside today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
To begin, why don't you just say your full name and your current role? And then if you don't mind sharing just your career from nursing school to where you are now.
Sure. So where I've landed in my current role is scientific director of a newly created institute that we are very excited about. It's a year in the making. Well, it's more than a year in the making, but it's been in existence for a year. So it's the Science of Care Institute, which is part of Sinai Health. I also am the research and innovation lead for the entire Sinai Health system, with the main role of building capacity for all staff, everyone at our hospital, clinicians, as well as support staff, which is really, really exciting. And I also am a senior scientist, so role modeling the way and have responsibility and accountability to generate new knowledge in my program area of research, which focuses on organizational learning and system performance. What does that mean? It means making our healthcare environment safer for clinicians, point of care, as well as administrators, as well as staff, to be able to be in work environments that make it conducive to provide the best care possible. And looking at now, particularly as we are in recovery efforts from the pandemic, how we actually can improve the way we practice our care and re-engage with caring practices. That's where I'm at right now, and I'll fill in the blanks along the way. I could go on, and I will. But in terms of my journey spent was quite interesting, because actually when I was in high school, I was very athletic and very interested in physiotherapy. And I had applied for physiotherapy at University of Toronto, with nursing actually as my second discipline that I was looking to explore. I wasn't accepted into physio. And I think, you know, things kind of happened serendipitously, because I ended up loving the first week or two of nursing at the Faculty of Nursing at University of Toronto. And was interesting because I actually had graduated in 1992, where the job market was not great. And so early days in my nursing career, I became very, very adept at working three different jobs. And I think that has served me well in terms of flexibility and moving parts. And so I was actually a health promotion nurse at University of Toronto. So that was really interesting, because I learned all about program planning and evaluation, as well as a real love for the community and a philosophy of the pedagogy of the oppressed, and really working to create equitable programs for as many people as possible to improve their health. And so the health promotion aspect was with student health. And so because I was freshly graduated, my lived experience as a student from University of Toronto, I think, served me well in some of my creative approaches and my ability to connect with
the students and work with them in a peer support program. So very early days, the capacity building amongst peers was something that I was able to do. And I still have to this very day, great programs that are building capacity and really sort of mentorship with peers as well. But I was also a pediatric nurse. I was working at then the Bloorview's Children's Hospital, which is now part of Holland Bloorview. So my background was pediatric chronic disease care, as well as I worked at a pediatrician's office, which was more primary care. So I kind of got the full spectrum, well, across the spectrum from, you know, primary care and the importance of keeping people healthy, but also to really caring practices with those that were living with chronic disease, cerebral palsy, muscular dystrophy, and very, very broad spectrum there. And then working in the pediatrician's office, seeing mostly healthy children, but as well, really zoning in on that family-centered care approach and how important that is for grounding nursing practice in every aspect that we do, regardless of setting. Then that was for the first few years. And then I thought I got the bug to go back to school and did my master's of science again at the Faculty of Nursing and went more into the health promotion aspect of it. And so by that time, I was now working at Ryerson, which is now the Toronto Metropolitan University, in a similar role, developing programs and services for mainly students, but also some of the staff. And then started really looking at how we can ground in like a data-driven approach, I guess is the best way to describe it. So my thesis focused on a needs assessment of what are the health needs of the university students, and did some surveying and interviews with students and land at a tool to really help assess that. And then I thought, okay, so I've got different experiences across the practice spectrum, but I was missing the policy piece. And so that drew me to do my clinical placement at the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario in the policy shop. So very early days, I got exposed to more what I would say the macro connection of healthcare, and, you know, had everything from the nurse practitioner to some of the health service restructuring. Again, I'm dating myself, back when Duncan Sinclair was leading that work, and really got to understand health policy again through health policy and equity as well, but nursing's huge contribution within that sphere. From there, I ended up going into the hospital sector at Hamilton Health Sciences, where I was chief of nursing practice for a short period of time. That was an interesting point, inflection in my career, because I had to make a choice and ended up coming back into academia, working with the dean at the time, Diane Alfonso, around patient safety. And so that was back in the day in the early 90s, mid-90s late 90s, when patient safety started to become quite prevalent on people's radars, because the reports were coming out globally around how care actually isn't where it should be, and that we were experiencing this across the world globally. And so then started to get more into the safety, patient safety, which then led me to really wanting to understand what we refer to nowadays as near misses or good catches. Led me to do some work within that role at University of Toronto, but also led me to do my PhD, where I had a tough decision to make whether it would be in nursing or health service research. And I ended up choosing health service research because, again, my knowledge gap always guided the work and opportunities that I reached out to. And so I knew that I had some pretty good understanding on what it's like to provide care at what we would call the clinical microsystem level, mm-hmm. and had some good background at a real macro level in terms of working at RNAO. Then, oh, I forgot. And I worked at the ministry as a senior policy analyst as well too, which then really kind of gave me the macro. But the meso and how organizations make decisions really intrigued me. And so that led me to do my PhD at the Institute for Health Policy Management and Evaluation with a world-renowned scientist, Dr. Ross Baker, who was the lead of the National Adverse Event Study with Peter Norton. And then I sort of never looked back and always kept grounded in that sort of praxis point of academia, practice setting, and then went to St. Mike's for 12 years as the director of nursing research, as well as finishing off my PhD, which then landed me another opportunity where I currently am at now at Sinai Health, which is the role that I'm in. That's a lot that I just shared with you, so I'm sure you have some follow-up questions.
And what was your PhD actually in? Did you mention it?
How do organizations learn and leverage near misses? Oh. The research was conducted at the Hospital for Sick Kids. At that time, they had actually had a near miss system in place. And so at the time, near misses were usually seen as quick fixes where people would deal with them in the moment and not necessarily report them. And then if you don't report them, then you don't necessarily learn from that. And so when near misses were more closely, what I would describe as more adverse events, then they were more likely to be reported and acted upon. And so that really sort of gave me a really good grounding again around how important it is to build capabilities within organizations for clinicians and staff to be able to provide safe care. And there's multiple ways to do that.
That is a lot of different roles, Leanne. You are an ambitious person.
Very cool. I lead where I'm led by where I can have the most impact, but I've created most of the positions I've held too, which is something that's really, really important to me as well. It's very rarely have I ever gone into a structured role. Usually the roles I've either co-created or they draw me in because there's something new. Since I love the build.
That's awesome.
The co-design.
Oh, very cool. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about today is listening through your career there are so many different kernels of expertise that you've been able to pull together. It seems like that's one of your great capacities.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think, you know, I've described this very recently too, that all roads have led to where I am today and the opportunities and experiences all sort of coalesced to create a brand new institute, which I shared with you initially. Yeah. And that was, I would say at Sinai, it's been almost 5 years in the making for sure. But a lot of the thought process that I had around creating the cultural ethos, and I'll share a bit more around how I did that, and not how we did it, how I helped lead many people within the organization in that pathway. We did the academic piece first. We put a paper out a couple of years ago for people to think about, pick apart, where we were suggesting that the science of care, which we coined that term back in our academic practice strategy that we released in 2017, 2018. And so we coined that term science of care.
Let's get to the science of care and let's focus around that. Because sometimes in the context of healthcare and medicine, like science and care are conceived of as being separate realms, you know, like science with measurement and controls and objectivity and replicability, and then caring, which is more subjective and interpersonal. Right, is something that is felt, the caring, whereas science maybe is more cognitive, although we have the duty of care, which relies on knowledge, right, and on science to set a standard for what's reasonable. But there are also times in healthcare where science and care are perceived to have been at odds, but you bring them together in a framework called the science of care, which is an innovative way of looking at things. So how do you understand the relationship between science and care?
Yeah, you know, it's quite interesting because the whole philosophy of the science of care and our institute, which is a part of Sinai Health, which is really focusing on see what care can do, is embodying this new frontier in healthcare, which really integrates the humanity of caring with scientific research and innovation. And so it's very interesting. And I've been doing a few talks in the last year, really trying to situate the currency of care, that we actually do have knowledge bases on care. And so within our framing of the science of care, and then I'll talk more about the institute, is really a focus on what we refer to as fundamental care. And this fundamental care has over 10 years of collective work from around the world that Dr. Allison Kitson has led with several of us, including our chief nurse executive, Jane Merkley, and myself, and Nellie Amaral at Sinai as well, too. Really trying to focus in on a real sort of holistic approach to care that brings together the physical, which is most obvious and most visible, the psychosocial, and also the relational, and really focusing in on the relational aspect of care. And that's the nexus of all the other scientific fields that we've brought in together within the framework, of which caring science is one. Obviously, how we provide compassionate care matters. The safety science, we know that people are falling. We know people are not getting the right medications. We know that people's symptoms also aren't necessarily being managed. And so people might be in pain and we know what to do about it. They might be fatigued. We have evidence to know how to provide care in that context. Their heart might be breaking. We know how to connect with people to make their experience matter and to listen to patients. And so the currency of care is really focusing in on what matters to people that you're providing care to. And the people are the patient in front of you, but also their care partners or their circle of loved ones as well too. And really, again, pediatric nurse, that whole philosophy of looking at the person is really, really, really important. And so that's really grounded in a real focus in on care and how we focus our efforts on the compassionate, empathetic, as well as understanding people's context, where they're at, and really working with people to co-design their care and curate their own care is extremely, extremely important within our framework.
So compassion, right, it's at the base of any kind of caring and the base of relationship. But, you know, in such a complex and interconnected environment where people have long stays, it is also more than just existing within people, right? It's influenced by our environment. What are some of the ways that you can enable a culture that where the compassion is activated?
Yeah, I think that's really, really important too. And it's interesting because where our purpose has landed for the Institute is making compassionate care matter. That is our main purpose. And so it's not rocket science, but it is science. There is a lot of science related to how we actually listen to patients, answering call bells, having conversations, really listening to what they're telling us, what matters to them, how they're feeling. And what we can do about that is so important. But it also starts with caring for ourselves, right? And I think that right now is so incredibly challenging as, again, we continue to recover from the pandemic, but now we're faced with human health resource challenges that were already starting to percolate before the pandemic. And so how do we create these environments that people feel the compassion and are able to provide compassionate care, I think, is really, really important. And so our Institute is using research and innovation and connecting clinicians and staff in innovative projects, in research to generate new knowledge or test out something, new ways to advance care so that we're investing in our workforce in order to strengthen the workforce, to bring back compassion and or infuse compassion so that in turn we are able as a healthcare workforce to provide the most compassionate care we can. But it's been a challenge, as you said, too, because there's this duty to care. And I just finished edits on a paper on moral injury from the work that we did with a survey in our hospital over 7 data points during COVID too, where, you know, we heard loud and clear that many people had experienced moral injury and moral tensions because they weren't being able to provide the care and the duty to care that we've been educated and yearned to do as good clinicians, as good staff. So it's really, I think, a combination. It's not a one size fits all. It's how do you build back resilience? How do you build back joy and meaning in work? And how can we leverage research, innovation, and just doing something maybe different or hearing something across the street that you want to try out, or always being able to be curious, I think, and connected to a community of care, I think is very, very important. And that's a key stream of why we actually then created a structure, not just the framework from a conceptual standpoint, which is empirically and theoretically based, but how do we create an actually organized institute structure and infrastructure to make this happen? And so our key KPI, our performance indicator, is how do we make care matter? And how do we actually move that dot?
You describe in one of your papers the core business of healthcare as being the provision of quality fundamental care. And I think most of us who work in the field know, like, we have a sense of what fundamental care is. You know, it's, as you describe, relational caring, understanding what matters to people, helping them feel heard and involved in the decision making so that they have a sense of agency and control, you know, addressing psychological needs, but also about, you know, care of the body, right?
Mm-hmm. It's that connection of the care of the body, the soul, the mind, and the very being of who you are as a person, and looking at what, again, matters in a holistic way to the people we're providing care for, and what we can and engaging. And I have a few examples on how do you engage patients and care partners to hold us accountable to provide that compassionate care as well, too.
And probably to give feedback into what they really want, right? Like patients and families want to be part of the designing of the, because it depends on process, the way we deliver care, fundamental care, the way we prioritize it. Because they're really, as you say, you know, this moral injury and bringing joy back into work is part of a sense of control of our time as care providers and feeling like what we're doing with our time is valuable and useful and beneficial. And providing, being able to meet the fundamental needs of our patients would definitely contribute to experiencing joy in work and having a sense of, you know, the, what we do matters and is helpful, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because we articulated very recently, this week, our strategic plan, which, you know, what we talked a lot about is what's driving our, you know, our advancement in the area of science of care. And our sort of four drivers that really sort of stuck out for us was the curiosity aspect, right? And and so how do you actually enhance people's ability to be curious, to be creative, to rethink how, what the future of care should look like through the questions we ask. Also connection. So that strong, trusting relationships between the people we provide care to. And really looking at how we create coherent care, particularly for complex patients, because as you know, you practice, like patients are very complex in hospitals. They, like if you're in a hospital, you're needing some complex acute care. And so really, really paying attention to how we connect. And then using co-design is everything that we do. And, you know, an example is in the summer, we worked with the quality portfolio and our patient family advisory council to land on a compassionate measure. So we did a co-design process where I presented three or four different frameworks that were known the best gold standard of how to actually measure compassionate care. And they decided which one they wanted to use and some open-ended questions that are now part of how we actually gauge our experience with patients. We had this opportunity because we used to use PICR, which would ask patients, would you recommend the hospital to another person? That doesn't get at care necessarily, right? It might get
not
at
an
service.
Actionable. Yeah,
it's not. Yeah, exactly.
We're
asking, like, were you listened to? Did you feel you received empathetic, compassionate care? And so the plan is, as we sort of pilot this out, this will then help guide not just only monitoring and measuring, but also to how we then, with the learning health system, use this data to drive what we do in our daily practice and resources that we might need to invest in where we're not seeing the experience of patients in a compassionate way where we need to. Or the other flip side is if you know, certain areas are getting really great scores as a collective, what are they doing that we can actually then share across the organization, which is that's where the organizational and system learning comes to play. That is part of our framework as well, too, within the science of care. We refer to it as a person-centered learning health system, which is the wraparound we provide the care in and really advance, again, through either innovation and new discoveries and research, new knowledge to how best to provide care.
Because when you talk about innovation and new ways, sometimes that doesn't necessarily bring to mind fundamental care. It brings to mind new technology or new approaches to things, but there you tend to feel that there is lots of room for innovation in how just providing fundamental care, and that that is actually very, very impactful.
Yeah, and within our innovation, because we actually have our impact statement is really not just transforming care, but society in deeply meaningful and profound ways. And so how do you do that? Well, we need to be agile and equitable, but it has to be centered in a human. So human-centered sense-making around care. And again, having that currency of care and health equity and really, really understanding their lived experience, beliefs, and values, and our own as those who provide care or create opportunities for healthcare delivery within it. But again, I'll come back to the currency of care, and you know, maybe care is the new cure. You know, maybe that's the way we should be looking at it, because you are in hospitals to receive care. and you're not always cured.
No, that is absolutely true.
You know, the currency is to look at the focus on care as important, and maybe even more important, depending on what matters to the people you're providing care to. Because some of the work I did earlier days when I've done a lot of qualitative work in my career, patients remember when they were treated with compassion and when they're not. And simple things like having hair washed, having your teeth brushed, those are fundamental care needs, but they matter to patients just as much and sometimes even more that if they fell without injury. And so, again, it's really, you know, making the what is so important to patients really up front. What matters to us as healthcare workers as well, too, and zoning in on the experience of care.
Yeah. Whenever we are a patient or a family member going to receive care, we're immediately reminded of that, aren't we? Because we're all recipients of the healthcare system as well. So we have a sense of what kind of service and services we imagine we would like to see for ourselves and for our patients. But the science of care draws upon a number of sciences to come together, right? And you described the first few, caring, yeah, safety, and symptoms. And how do you, I mean, one of the great challenges is around use data, we generate insights, we see gaps, or we understand what best practice might be, but actually doing it in our own environments is a whole other challenge, really. Adapting, changing in such a complex, complicated place that is the world of delivering healthcare. So what are you drawing upon in order to have inspiration for how to go about doing this?
Yeah, and what I shared earlier with the fundamental care and the sort of integration of the caring symptom and safety science is really the what in terms of we're talking about care. But and I talked about the outer circle, which is the person-centered learning health system, which is the context. But then there's the sort of mid-core, which is the how, to your point. And so we initially started off with team science, which was essentially, you know, we are in partnership with each other, including care partners. We are different disciplines. We are different service support workers that sort of all interact on a daily basis in our healthcare system to provide care. And then implementation science, which has gained ground over the last decade on really looking at your context of care. So looking at barriers and facilitators to enable the best way to implement a new change in practice, something new about care, a new care process, a new treatment. That was our first two. And that's sort of, you know, early days, both with Jane and I, with our CEO, Dr. Gary Newton at the time. And then we started having conversations with actually the faculty of nursing and others like Dr. Carolyn Steele Gray, who is very much in the innovation space. And we added innovation science, which is focusing on design thinking. And there's a whole theoretical scientific base around design thinking. So how do you actually accelerate getting things into practice? And then also to quality improvement and improvement science. And again, there's profound theoretical, empirical explanations and tools that we can use as we go about our change in practice and change in cultural ethos. And so the whole science of care framework is looking at things holistically. And so in some cases, you might cover off all, depending on exactly what you're looking at to change or do or explore. And other times you might be zoning in a particular area to generate new knowledge around. We draw on a lot of our colleagues for the different ways in which you can implement care. And we'll be designing more in the innovation space, which is really exciting because we are building a center for innovation within the Science of Care Institute, where the space right now is this big open space. And we're going to be having our co-design sessions to see what the possibilities might be able to be. It's not just meant for scientists to, you know, have the space in place. It's for everyone to come and ideate and prototype and have an opportunity to think in a new space within a very psychologically safe space, because that's extremely important, as we talked about earlier, on rebuilding resilience and connection to our workforce again, to be able to be in these safe places to trial out different things and different ideas and different thoughts. So that kind of gives you a little bit of the taste of the how.
Yeah, just being able to be creative and think about things and bounce ideas off of each other, because we can't really do that off the side of our desk while we're busily engaged in actually doing the care work, right? But we do need to have space to think about how we could improve the way we do things, because there's obviously room for improvement everywhere, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the ideal world, we would create these living labs within the clinical spaces that do enable you to have the ability to think outside the box.
Yeah.
But as a leader, for me, that's one of the greatest challenges we're facing, because ironically, we're getting money in from philanthropy. We have a Center for Nursing Excellence, which is another pillar of the Science Care Institute. But our greatest challenge right now is being able to access you as clinical nurses, point of care nurses, as an example, because of the staffing challenges. And so really trying to figure out how we can, you know, engage the workforce in different ways. So it's not off the side of your desk. It's part of what you do in a daily basis.
Yeah, that's a wonderful vision, because it's true that we are swamped sometimes and there seems like there's very little extra capacity anywhere, but it's like, well, we've never needed to change and adapt more than we are going to. And it appears as though if you've been in a place that has gone through a process of a major change, you get all the gears in place and the machinery set such that changing afterwards and adapting is less difficult. It feels like you can kind of gain momentum or practice being open to learning and changing. Does that seem to stack up into what you understand?
Yeah, I think it's really important as we start to, not start to, in our continued efforts, you know, sure, we are Sinai Health, but what we're creating at Sinai Health is for society at large. And so how do we also create maybe different ways of interacting and sharing our discoveries and our insights? Part of trialing things out doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get the intended outcome, mm-hmm. but you're definitely going to learn a lot along the way and maybe what not to do the next time around. Or maybe you realize you have a bit of a mismatch between what you thought the problem was and what the solution you tried out. And that's why, again, I get back to that co-design and connecting with people who you're trying to build something for, or in the context of your daily practice care for, is building in that time with the people you're providing care to, as well as the people you're providing care with, which mm-hmm. is your team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, opportunities to connect and build together are valuable, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you need to go big or go home on this one too. I think, you know, I bring us back to compassion, because, you know, what we see, what's going on in society right now, and compassion is eroded globally on so many levels. How can we use how we care about ourselves and care about others within, yeah, healthcare system, as an example, though, as if we are compassionate, then the world will be more compassionate. And so I think it's also a call to action for us at this point in time, particularly within the nursing profession, or those, anyone who's in the caring profession, to really think about their role in what they do on a daily basis as someone who is providing care, but also as a citizen as well, and to be compassionate and sort of observant around what the world is going through right now, that it lives out in our ecosystem of healthcare.
Yeah, it strikes me that healthcare is needs to be compassionate to all people. And, you know, we've got the crisis of homelessness and opioids and so many challenges faced not equally across all different cross sections of society, be they race, gender, sexuality, whether you're born here or somewhere else, whether you're housed or not. There's lots of reason to examine compassion in our policies and to look at all levels, right? We are being compelled to do that as any healthcare provider and organization. So how do you co-design your process of doing that?
It's a really, really good question. And for what we've done in the past, and when I say we, not just me, partnering with also other experts, like when I think of the work that St. Michael's Hospital, where I formed, they have for many years had a focus on the most socially disadvantaged individuals in our city. But I'm sure you've seen over the course of the years too, I think every hospital in downtown Toronto, maybe even periphery, they used to call St. Mike's the urban angel. And I see similar, you know, social disadvantaged individuals, marginalized individuals.
Oh, yeah.
it's a reality wherever you are, not just in Toronto as well too, but that's where that sort of connection to the reality and their lived experience is so important, because if you haven't lived it and you're responsible for trying to design new care models or care processes and you haven't engaged the very people that you're trying to provide better quality, compassionate care to, you're going to miss the boat. And that's fundamental for human factors engineering, which is the safety science as well as implementation science. So it's really taking time to get to know the people you're providing care to, really understanding from their world and their perspective what matters to them in terms of what would a caring experience look like, what's a good one, what's a bad one, and how do you then think through and work with them to really, you know, provide the care and meet them where they need to be met is really, really important. And then again, the perfect example is what I shared earlier around making sure that the metrics you are collecting they're capturing deeply how care is experienced and from the people that you're providing care to. And that's where, again, the co-design evaluation, which is a huge function of the Institute, is around exploring, monitoring, and evaluation of new ways of being, new ways of caring. Because, you know, there's a saying in performance measurement that you can't manage what you can't measure. And so that in itself, if you're not capturing in meaningful ways to those you're trying to move the dot with or the experience on, you know, you're missing the boat. And
technology really enables that in ways that would have been a lot more burdensome in the past, right? Like the capacity to generate data and to collect data it's much simpler now, isn't it?
But there's also the digital divide, which is referred to, that can also further divide marginalized and socioeconomic determinants of health sort of criteria, where technology is great if you can access it and it works, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And it enables your experience to be smoother. But certainly, and that's, again, a lot of work that Dr. Carolyn Steele-Gray, who's one of our scientists with the Science Care Institute, is tackling in a digital space too, is how do you make digital tools equitable and also really sort of meaningful to and impactful to the people that she's working with, which in this current context right now involves digital tools for enhancing the care transitions experience of patients as they discharged home.
As they go home. Yeah, that would be really important because some people are going home to very precarious environments. Truly.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And are not connected to services in the community. Which then what happens, then the likelihood of them coming back in to be either through emergency or readmissions, because maybe their needs, how they would be able to carry out the follow-up plans of care if by chance the home environment structurally or emotionally is not such that it's conducive for carrying out the plan for recovery at home.
Yeah, because people are living with profound functional changes after coming into hospital sometimes. That's just the other side of the technological advances that are incredible, the way we can help people survive things that they wouldn't have been able to before and regain lots of function, but they're changed afterwards and require new levels of adaptation.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of science, right? Yeah. Science and innovation, right? Got to get that in there. You're absolutely right. And so how do we actually make sure that we're looking at things systematically or deal with the current realities of what the gaps in healthcare are and or what we know to work as well to address some of these thorny, wicked problems in healthcare and society as well too. And so it's a key part of, again, thinking ahead of the curve, which is what we as scientists try to do and predict and, you know, bring us to a place where people are getting the compassionate care where they need it, by whom they want it from, in ways that actually matter to them. I think, again, and that's really authentically connecting with people around their life story and their narrative around what matters to them is so important in this space. And we remind ourselves that too, in terms of that's the core that we actually center all our new grants in, attraction of new people to the Institute, and also too, as we move forward on different types of programs and services offered. We're thrilled that we are starting more connection with youth in the future. We're hoping to get a few students in through the Lunenfeld-Tannenbaum Research Institute, which is at Sinai Health as well, summer program. There's also opportunities at March break to bring in the youth, young individuals, again, where possible from marginalized communities so that they can get exposed to the science of care and healthcare in general to hopefully get them excited about a potential career. And maybe it's not a clinician, maybe it's a biomedical engineer or human factors engineer or someone in material reprocessing. Like, there's so many aspects of care that people can get involved in because, you know, the group that I just mentioned, well, they are key partners in making sure that our patients don't get infections, right? And so it's not just clinicians, it's actually everyone within our healthcare system in the walls or in the community or outreach has a role around making sure that we're providing compassionate care.
And I think that the better integrated we can all be, and there's so many moving parts, you're absolutely correct, from the people who deliver food trays to the preparers of the food, everyone contributes, and the processing of samples, all of it, moving people
all
around
it,
the hospital,
lab,
all
yeah.
of it.
And I'll give you an example.
It's mind-boggling how interconnected everything and complicated it all is.
It is, but it's fun. Complexity is great. A really neat story. When we were doing a study, I think this was just before COVID or maybe just, anyway, doesn't matter when it was. So we were doing a study with a group that was led by a group of nurses in our neonatal intensive care unit on family-centered care that had been introduced by one of the physicians in partnership with the nursing team. And so when we were interviewing, I helped the team figure out how to do the analysis. So I was able, privileged to read the narrative that the family members had provided who were interviewed. And there was a couple of narratives that emerged that there was one environmental service worker in particular that the families talked about and their interactions with this person that would come in to clean the NICU. And as you can appreciate, you know, infection is I did a practicum in NICU. Babes can get infected and really, really get sick very, very fast. So having clean rooms is so important. Anyways, and the mothers of two babes, I remember, shared about how they really enjoyed their conversation and connection with this environmental service worker and saw them as part of their care team.
I see that a lot, actually. People really develop relationships. They leave gifts. They become really important, really, really nice. And meaningful, I think, for the staff too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but it is deeply interconnected. I think care exists. People have needs that rely on really coordinated processes to meet. Often needs of patients need to be met by a system, not just individuals, right? And so, you know, there's organizational context that enables higher functioning in teams and enables compassionate care to be delivered. Can you just describe what some of those elements of organizational context that support it are?
I think the tone at the top is obviously really, really important and cascading across all levels. So leadership matters. You have to have leaders that embody compassion as part of the essence of the fabric of the organization that you're working in. It's also creating these psychologically safe spaces and places, and we have work to do on that, and that probably will always continue to need to have attention to around that. So you're creating these, again, person-centered learning health systems where you're using data, you're using patient experience, you're using the workforce data to really influence how we actually go about, whether it's creating programs, positions, whatever. But it's also the cultural ethos that creating the healthcare experience, whether you're working in it or receiving care in it, that's not only scientifically advanced, but also what we would say deeply human and really focusing in on the people. And the people, again, being those that are working, like yourself and myself, as well as the communities, the populations, the people we provide care to as well. It's investments. Like, we have an investment in this institute that's main purpose is to focus on care and to make compassionate care matter, right? And we're looking to do that by how we put out there, you know, our sort of cultural ethos around redefining the value of care and the currency of care through how we lead both science and innovation, not just organizationally, but like, let's go global with this, because we've got some real talent, both within our hospital, but it's also the partnerships as well. And so there's partnerships within organizations like Sinai Health, but also to our intersectoral partners related to focusing in on how do we actually connect more. So we've got the circle of care, for instance, that's part of Sinai Health, that depending on where you work clinically, you might not have even heard of it, might not have much connection with it, but that is care in the community and home-based care as well too. And so looking through how do we actually enhance the partnerships as well, it's investing. And so a large part of the role that I have now is working to create business cases and storylines and narrative so that the foundation who raises philanthropic dollars, whether it's individual donors or through corporations or organizations, it's also selling the story around why care matters to those who are doing fundraising and co-creating the space for these discussions to occur. And that's what happened with the Center for Nursing Excellence a few years ago. One of our board members, foundation board members, put forward the idea of really wanting to invest in nursing. And so she basically said, okay, I am going to put in an investment. Who's with me? And then within, I think, 6 months, had pledges of $10 million to create the Center for Nursing Excellence, which is an investment in the infrastructure and really valuing nurses as researchers, as innovators, as leaders.
And that's something that you've really championed for a long time, isn't it? I've heard you speak about, you know, the role, the position of nurses and why that makes us sort of natural program designers and innovators.
Exactly. We anyone who's like, you know, the interface of the provision of care, nursing, obviously, particularly in hospitals, we're 24/7. And so we have the most time and space with patients than most other healthcare providers.
Symptom science is a major domain of ours too.
And symptom for sure it is as well. And I mean, there's some shared obviously with social work and pharmacy and other health disciplines is where for sure too. But the investment within the Center for Nursing Excellence was to recognize the value and then also build on, as you know, we're the only magnet hospital in Canada, and sort of build on the momentum of and pride in sort of nursing excellence. And so where we've broadened that out within the Science of Care Institute is to also include workforce magnetism, so that in addition to nursing excellence, the profession of nursing, it's all health disciplines, including physicians. It's all staff, which is a unique of focus as well too. So that we had some of medical device reprocessing present and have funded to do some new innovations as well, and just try out some different techniques of reprocessing medical devices. And so to me, you know, if I look back, if you were to ask me what would be an element of success, in addition to moving the dot on compassionate care for people we provide care to, but also ourselves, it's actually how many unusual suspects are now, you know, leading these projects. Because, like, I'm sure environmental service workers have better ideas, whether it's a product they use, whether it's a workflow process, whether it's a communication technique. You know, the people have really good ideas. You know, I joke sometimes that I'm the chief ideas officer of the hospital in the sense that, you know, a key role of mine is to create opportunities for these ideas. Well, for people to be able to think and have space to have the ideas, but then also pathways where to go. And so
that's isn't it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So you might have a great idea. So maybe it is a research or through inquiry. Maybe it's you just need to do something about it, but do it systematically using quality improvement tools. Maybe it's actually something new you want to trial out. And so you use design thinking to bring it through the process. And then there's also implementation as well too. And so again, that's sort of the middle core of the framework sort of brought to life in sort of what we're trying to create through the Institute, as well as our culture ethos around the science of care at Sinai Health.
It sounds really exciting, you know, like, yeah, that makes so much sense if you want to drive change, which we know we need to adapt and change. And if you want to create a learning environment or learning organization, which sounds like one that I certainly want to work in, right? Who wouldn't choose to work in an environment like that? Especially when the outcomes are health and safety of our patients who we're all doing this for, in service of, and our communities and for our own families, right? We're all working towards a better future for ourselves and our communities. That's why we do the work that we do, isn't it?
But exactly.
Yeah, right? So the motivation is always there to do what's right and better for our communities and our patients and ourselves and colleagues. Like, we're a very devoted, team-oriented bunch. But having something in place, like structures in place to facilitate getting together with other people from other disciplines to work on some of these, as you describe, complex wicked problems, seems like it would be so beneficial. But it's relatively new, tackling problems in this way. Why do you think that it's not more widespread?
I think it's, you know, it takes a lot of moving parts to coalesce, in that, you know, you need obviously support from executive, you need someone to spearhead it, which is the role that I have the honor of being in right now, and as I evolve it too. But you're absolutely, the transdisciplinary collaboration is really, really important. And, you know, it was opening the doors and getting, you know, Gary Bassey, who is one of the directors in the material reprocessing, I never get his title straight, but getting them excited about putting grants in for innovation and really thinking about things as a collective in this transdisciplinary lens, where you have people that are working with clinicians that are actually the ones that are creating new ways of cleaning, new ways of taking lab specimens, new, you know, the list goes on too. And it's really interesting because then it brings a real holistic thought process to how do we actually improve care, and or how do we spread and scale and sustain what we know is working in this particular context, and maybe how do we might have to, I think you used the word adaptability earlier on, how do we adapt to local context? And then you even drill it down further, how do you then personalize care? And I'm not talking about precision medicine, but precision medicine would be a part of that. But, you know, how do you actually really tailor and provide holistic care to the individual such that at a collective level, you move the dot on the compassionate care outcomes and experiences?
Mm-hmm.
And compassion's always been an interesting word for me, because when you break it down, you have the latter part being passion, and then the front part always reminds me of company. And so what I like about the word compassion is that it's this collective of, and the passion for care, right? And so I think in order to provide compassionate care, we have to be compassionate to ourselves, but we also have to care about others in ways that are deep and meaningful in order to be able to interact with them and really get a sense on where they're at, but also how they're feeling. How do you actually use ways in which we know from science and experience to even approach asking some of the questions so that people feel safe to share how they might feel, particularly from different cultures or older generations that were very stoic and or afraid to share how they were feeling if they were afraid of repercussions or just not being heard, which I've heard a lot in some of the qualitative work I've done over the last 20 years.
That people are guarded about how they'll be received if they speak?
Yeah. Or they've been silenced in the past, or they felt that they haven't been listened to, or they're, what they've shared hasn't been taken seriously or ridiculed or taken into consideration with their care needs, are sometimes reluctant to share going forward in the future.
I mean, the Science of Care Institute, as you're creating it, is relying heavily on philanthropic money, right?
It is, yes.
Yeah, which is obviously one of the benefits of working in a place like Toronto. Can you see how other organizations could build on the work that Sinai does? Like, do you share it? Do you promote it? How do you see that?
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny because I've had a conversation last week with another organization that was asking, you know, how did you do it at Sinai Health? Like, how did you get a Center for Nursing Excellence and this institute? And obviously, as an academic, I stay tuned, a publication to follow. but our impact statement includes society, and that means beyond Sinai Health. And so we will be open doors to share the experience around how we did it. But we weave together the narrative of what matters to people. That's one part. You then also need to have, again, leadership who opens the doors. And so, you know, early days before COVID, Jane Merkley and I, we were invited to the board of directors meeting to talk about what is the science of care? I had the opportunity, I had 5 minutes, and I had the visualization of the science of care framework, which at that time did not include improvement and innovation science, and just drafted narrative. I have never practiced a speech that much. That, and then when I went to, a couple years later during COVID, when I was asked to present to the board of director foundation, or the foundation board, where I actually practiced that, those words, because it was so that moment, right? It's like that one moment in time where the door is open and really have to think through and use it wisely. And so I've shared speaking notes before with others, but the Institute is meant to be a community resource. And as we build it, that's really important. And as I had mentioned, we have the innovation space that we're going to be doing co-design sessions in. We will be doing sessions with our community, so community partners, but also academic partners, other hospitals. I'm often leading multi-site grants now that we pull people in, but we're meant to be a resource and a social asset to others that don't necessarily have, and nor will they ever be able to necessarily raise the type of funding that we have at Sinai Health. But we don't see ourselves as a competitor whatsoever. We see ourselves as a hub and spoke model, where it makes most sense for us to be the hub for a Center for Nursing Excellence, because we're the only hospital in Canada that has something like this yet. But hopefully more will follow, because we call this isomorphic competition in organizational behavior. But hopefully people will sort of go, hey, you know, especially as we start to demonstrate more impactful stories with what we've done and been able to invest our funds with, and how it changed care and made it more compassionate, you know, then it becomes more of an easier sell for organizations when the proof of concept is done.
And the proof of concept comes from your emphasis on evaluation. So you're always measuring the impact, or?
Measuring impact, but also just the relationships we build with people as well too. So it's multi-layered,
and that's like
around
qualitative.
Yeah. And how do you get in people's headspace? Like, mm-hmm. How did we get into our CEO's headspace? How do we get into the CEO of our foundation's headspace to actually have that compassionate care matter? And
advancing nursing along with that? Is that
nursing,
part of
advancing,
it?
I was advancing nursing along with that. And also to the currency of care, right? And so making people say, hey, this needs to be invested in just as much, or maybe in a different way, than some of the wet bench that is curing cancer or cures for cancer, which is very important.
Yes.
But so is care.
Absolutely.
And that's why, like I said to you earlier, and use the coin phrase, currency of care, throughout some of our conversation here, is that it's that constant never losing sight of, never missing out on an opportunity to talk about care and why it matters and why we need to be compassionate in our ways we provide care and the way we think of redesigning care.
And so when you do that and you're always talking about care, I mean, because a lot of the time fundamental care is kind of the be real to all the other stuff, right? It's kind of the what goes on in the background. And when it all goes well, nothing flashy happens, somebody recovers. When there's the absence of the fundamental care, that's when things kind of fall apart. And that's where you collected in your adverse events or near misses data and stuff like that to monitor.
Yeah.
I understand that.
And we mapped, we're about to, it's already published. So a recent article in the Journal of Nursing Care Quality that I led with, it was a national study with the former Canadian Patient Safety Institute, which is now Healthcare Excellence Canada. So just published literally like a couple of weeks ago. We interviewed patients from across Canada about their experience related to care. And what they were saying is that safety is beyond harm, right? Because when you think it's, and when you think of how we measure safety, it's like, okay, how many falls? How many medications errors do we have? How many, you know, and it's a count of what went bad. And so part of what the discussion...
A narrow count of what went bad.
Very narrow, exactly. So, and again, we're really trying to redefine how we view care and how we measure care. And so, to your point, we're constantly looking at ways to connect, whether it's qualitatively or quantitatively, to use that data to, again, give a state of, like, what's the current state? What's a baseline? How, let's use this to measure. And so the other part of that study was we actually went through a World Cafe with a colleague of mine, Dr. Carrie Kaluski, who's a Trillium Health Partner, who's a chair in patient care experience. So we actually then also ideated out through a World Cafe on what could we do to address the needs of patients and ground up interventions. And so we have a report out on that. And that was also recently published on health expectations on a series of strategies. And we're just now looking at what's next to try out and again, innovate through scholarly inquiry, these different types of strategies that they talked about. Some were digital tools, as we talked about earlier, around, hey, can I get my patient records on my iPhone so that, you know, I'm the custodian of my own information. I've got my whole, you know, and there's some different apps that are already being created for that too. But also too, just ways in which when errors happen, how do we actually make sure that in compassionate ways, we disclose the errors and we talk about how mitigating strategies we're going to put in place to make, or corrective action to make sure that these types of errors don't happen again. Because my experience years ago was that when errors happen, as tragic and sad as some of the extent of them are, people want to know, you know, they want an apology to say, I'm really sorry this happened. Mm-hmm. And they also want to know what's going to be done in place so that it doesn't hopefully impact someone else like it has to them.
Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. That's what people seem to want, isn't it? Because errors do happen.
It's human. Yes. They're going to happen. And, you know, and throughout my dissertation, I became quite fond of a field of within safety science called resilience engineering. And resilience engineering talks about how do you put buffers in the system so hopefully that errors don't happen. And so we refer to things like heuristic tools. So that's things like stickers on charts, you know, all these sort of alert that might be able to help the clinician go, oh, maybe I should do a double check. Oh, but then there's a fine balance as you as a clinician can understand. Sometimes there's an offset where actually you have an unintended consequence where there's just too many triggers. Yeah. Or too many heuristic tools that then it defeats the purpose and creates more of an opportunity for error to occur. And so it's kind of looking at the world through the famous Swiss cheese model where, you know, there's a whole bunch of the factors that line up in the context with care, where care is provided, staffing, lighting, bad systems, workflow process, that, you know, if the holes are lining up, it's going to end up in an event happening, whether it's a near miss, adverse event, or unfortunately, you know, a never event or a sentinel event where someone is actually injured so badly that they actually die.
Yeah. Which, yes, yeah, so sad.
But we're on a happier note. Like that's reality, which, yes, you know, yes, thank God doesn't happen. That is why though safety science was really important to put into our conceptual framework, as well as the improvement as the methodology to address these safety issues and quality gaps.
Yeah, the methodology of how to make it better. Sometimes we know what the challenges are, and just the question of how to get even towards just doing what we do well even better, or, you know, changing, modifying some of the ways we do things to be less burdensome, or with new evidence says X, let's try to change towards that as a standard. You know, these things all take time and coordination and you know, expertise and leadership, right? So it sounds like you're putting all those mechanisms into place to support people to hopefully be able to engage more with that and have a positive impact on the processes of their work environment. So where do you see the science of care kind of taking the organization, let's say in 10 years, if Leanne Jeff has her way?
If we I'm going to say the $50 million question, you know, I think in 10 years, it's flourishing. It's financially invested in that is in perpetuity. And so that's where things like endowed funds come in. There are highly performing, compassionate individuals that are part of the more formal, structured part of the Institute. But that, as I mentioned earlier, that everyone in our health system in Sinai Health, if they have an idea, they know where to go to take it to a place, and that there is investment opportunities for it. That as a collective, again, we've moved the dot on people, and people stay because this is a very much as it is generating new knowledge in care, in the caring space, it's also creating an environment where we retain the best and the brightest, whether that's scientists, clinicians, staff, where we provide opportunities through the programmatic work that we do, through the grants, through the capacity building, our research 101, our innovation. We're looking to have hackathons, pitchathons. I think I shared that with you before, like innovative ways to get people in a space to take their ideas through transdisciplinary, different disciplines, different people that are sharing a common problem that they want to see addressed in the caring space, which also includes the environment, because again, it's hard to provide exceptional, exquisite, compassionate care if you're not necessarily working in a caring, exquisite, compassionate environment. And so how do you do that too? But it's that everyone feels that they are involved in every day, ensuring that we are delivering the best compassionate care that we can. And that you know, obviously has impact, outcome measures, experiences, but we're truly demonstrating that we are a person-centered learning health system where we carefully monitor, we adapt, we're agile, and we listen, and we do all the tenets of empathy, curiosity, compassion are what we know we're doing on a daily basis in some shape or form. I think that would be something that would be really, really possible to attain in 10 years from now. But it is, because this is taking 5 years at Sinai, and me being in the space for almost 30 years, where, you know, thinking about how do I actually contribute as a citizen, as well as a professional to this world, to making it more compassionate. How do we actually make sure that people are connecting in deeply meaningful ways? Because that's what creates a better society. That's what creates better health. And then some of the economic value, which we haven't talked about as well, too, that it also saves money, because if you're doing things in a compassionate way that's appropriate or right, and then you're not redoing things, you're not causing harm, you're saving money and efficiencies because you're providing compassionate care, and which includes being safe and attuned to their symptoms, how we want to care for them, as well as keeping people safe in the spaces we provide care.
And attracting excellent practitioners then, who
100%
raise right, each other's game.
To your point, like you said, that like that's the world I want to live, right? Where you're actually in your daily practice, you have time to have, I would call it white space. You have time to actually think about your practice versus just doing because you have to get things done because there's time pressure. And yes, you know how to get things done because there's standards of practice and evidence that guides what we do. But you have opportunities. Maybe we should be doing something different, because there's for instance, there's a whole body of evidence that talk about de-adoptions of practices.
Yeah.
That, you know, why do we do things? Why do we give medication out at 8, 12, 4, and 8?
Exactly.
Has anyone ever studied, is that the best from a physiological standpoint for patients to be getting, you know, medications at that time frame, or is that more of a workflow?
Does a schedule blood work every day for 5 days at 6 a.m. do more harm than good? Could we, yeah. You know, like, could we rebate?
Well, I mean, fatigue is one of the symptoms, right?
And so, destruction of their vasculature.
Yes, sleep is huge. Like, you know, yeah. We have a couple of funded projects that we're looking at. They call it sleep hygiene, which is something that was a new coin that was termed a couple of years ago with one of the project teams. And so, I mean, I know I can speak personally on the value and the need for good sleep in order to actually, you know, be able to function. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine when you're having a lack of sleep or being poked at different hours and not getting the sleep in environments where you're trying to recover. Because as we mentioned before, if you're in a hospital and if you're in an acute care hospital, you're likely pretty sick and complex. And so you need all you can get to help you recover, which includes a good sleep.
And
which is a key part of fundamental care.
It is, isn't it? Fundamental care with the sleep, the skin care, the comfort, bathing, you know, managing all the fluids that come in and out of you, nutrition. Like, there's a lot to it, really.
There's a lot to it.
And like I said, complexity.
I know. I can tell you too, as I said, I've heard patients are like, we just really like my hair washed, right?
I know.
I like my teeth. And so teeth brushing, oral health is really interesting too, because there's both the safety science perspective, because if you're actually not doing oral health like you should be, it's a portal for infection, right? Whether you're in ICU and you get ventilated acquired pneumonia or other, you're not necessarily ventilated, but it's a quality issue because, you know, halitosis and
or you can't eat.
the sores or the gut hurts, mm-hmm. right? And then they're in pain. And we know there's lots of and nursing has a lot to provide in that space too. As does, it's interesting because Sarah Beth Silver, one of our CNSs, you know, held a few years ago getting to the tooth symposium or sort of think tank that she brought people together where it had dentistry and I think even some of social work as well, some of the other health disciplines as well. Again, so the Institute again is really trying to really ignite people to think of where their ideas could go. And again, to really focus in on that, you know, the essence of our, like, really being exceptional healthcare is not just on clinical outcomes, but in the human experience with everybody we provide care to.
Yeah, and I think we think of innovation as always being a device or a product, right? But actually, it can just be a care process, can't it?
It could be a care process. It could be, you know, so years ago when I was at St. Mike's, there was a group on our surgical floor that wanted to do something different around. The problem was people were falling and they were all set to do a strategy during the day. But then when they looked at their data, they're like, well, when do you think most falls occur in that unit?
Yeah, like 11 p.m.
Nighttime, yeah. Exactly. During the night. And why do we think people fall during that time? They have to go to the bathroom. And then you start to deconstruct, well, maybe the nurses aren't being able to get to the call bell. Maybe they're not calling the call. So they ended up reconfiguring what they ended up doing. And they started to do hourly rounding in, but they would not wake the patients up if they were sleeping, but they would check into if they were up to say, do you need to go to the bathroom? Are you thirsty? Are you, you know, all those fundamental care things. So they actually did a bundled fundamental care intervention and they did find that their fall rates went down and the fall with injuries, because the falls with injuries that also had the most occurring during that time period.
Mm-hmm. Which is the basic, right? The hourly rounding.
It's fundamental care. Yeah, exactly.
Sure is.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time, Leanne, and for sharing all of these threads of knowledge that you hold, that you are weaving together to try to really forward care for patients in a compassionate way, in an integrated way, in a coordinated way that centers nursing and needs that patients and families identify. I think most anyone in the field can definitely rally behind that. And I wish you all the success on behalf of all the nurses in your organization and as well as, you know, for you. But one of the challenges I find is, yeah, analyzing, collecting data and evaluating. And that's something that you offer a lot of mentorship and support with, is it not? So do you have words of inspiration or advice for nurses who are thinking about, you know, that's often a hurdle for people. They have the idea, but how do you demonstrate that it worked? How do you make sure you're on the right track?
So I think, you know, it's like, come join us is my first. Shamelessly, come join us at Sinai Health. And that's where we're really paying closer attention. So we do offer capacity building. We started with the research, which we're calling more the 101 series. But again, it's the challenges with that is actually getting to it. So we are looking to create online asynchronous learning very, very like micro learnings is the best way to describe it. Because right now we're doing hour-long sessions that, you know, it's great if you can get to it, but there's hardly ever any staff nurses that can get to it. We've also been asked in the years gone past to come to the nursing council or the unit councils as well, too, where we've done some very shortened 101. So for it's building the programmatic stuff. It's reaching out. Like, I'm happy to talk to anybody who's interested in research and or innovation in the caring space, in the compassionate caring space, but it's finding your people, it's finding mentorship opportunities within this space. And that's a huge part of what I do. And quite frankly, one of the joys of all the positions I've had in the last, I would say, even since when I was at University of Toronto, I had a group of seven undergrad students, you know, that were working with us on the near-miss study. I absolutely love, and I think it's a duty of mine. And this is the beauty of, as we build the Center for Nursing Excellence, we build out the people. We're having our first inaugural embedded nurse scientist that starts next week with us. So we're building capacity at that level, which then just cascades to more opportunities to connect around it. But, you know, I guess, and this is from a sort of more of a personal journey perspective, which sometimes it can be really painful in terms of when you're out there and you're trying to advocate for something that is transformative. People don't always want to change. And you really have to be resilient within yourself and stay the course, you know, have your North Star, which for me is, you know, having a just society, how healthcare is core to that, and how compassionate care is core to both society, as well as how we provide care. And I think it's really having a very solid sense of who you are and your own philosophy on what it is that you think this world should be and what it is you think care should be. You know, you might kind of get knocked down for a day or two, dust yourself off and just remind yourself of that and that you can make a difference. You know, I came from a small town in Northern Ontario, and now I'm leading an institute that hopefully will have global impact as well as local. And so, you know, dream, but connect with people that can help lift your dream and make it happen, I think is really, really important. And I know that sounds like, ooh, I'm cheerleading, but it's the truth. It really is. And just, you know, you might have to get used to sometimes rejection. Like, I'm still battling with CIHR to fund the study in third round. But I think as long as you remain true to yourself and the core of what your philosophy is, and who you are as a person, and just seek out like-minded people to work with you. There's many of us that actually are doing this not for ourselves, not for the institute and organization we work for, but for the larger, you know, the larger cause of making sure that people get the best care they can, and that it's reflective of what they want their care to be, both the outcomes and experience.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note to end on.
Excellent. Well, and thank you for this opportunity. Very rarely do I get to talk for an hour and a half. About, it's been an honor actually connecting with you on this as well too, and really appreciate the opportunity. And hopefully some of these words will inspire, inform others in their efforts, regardless if it's for innovation or research. But hopefully there's some good nuggets out of this conversation with you that people can learn from and reflect on.
Thanks so much, Leanne. And thank you, listener. If you can take a moment, please follow the link in the show notes or through to the episode webpage and offer your feedback. There is a short survey to evaluate this podcast I offer at the bedside as a way to learn and explore. I'd love to know what you think or any suggestions you might have. This season of At the Bedside is supported by grants from the Registered Nurses Foundation of Ontario Nurse Innovator Award and through the Science of Care Institute at Sinai Health System. I am, as always, grateful to the nurses of Sinai's 14 North, St. Joe's Hamilton's 7 Nephrology, and 4 Chest for their examples of what nursing can be. Thank you for listening, and be well.